Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Alexis L podcast. And usually emails that come at you out of the blue from solicitors are unwelcome. dear sir, the inquiry into the, animal impersonator scandal. I don't know where I'm going to go with that, really. There's a whole heap of trouble I could get myself into improvising around that theme. But a while ago, in the middle, I think, of last year, I got an email from a solicitor called Paul Heron telling me about, basically informing me about how I had been spied on by a special branch. And I had a special branch file. So Paul is now, and also Paul is kind of central to the whole SpyCops inquiry, which we will get into. And Paul is with me now. So hi, Paul.
Hey, Alexi, how are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you. So tell me about this file that you discovered, basically.
Well, it wasn't so much a file as such. The best way to describe it is during the course of the undercover policing inquiry, public disclosure, which is all available on their website, it lists all kinds of meetings that undercover officers attended. Sometimes they attended gigs and parties. And your name was mentioned publicly here, which is disclosed on the website of the public inquiry as someone that was mentioned in a report referring to a gig that you did for an organization called the Right to Work campaign, which you probably recall from the dim and distant 1970s. Mm-hmm. And if you look at that page, which people can search for, it has a list of people who are in attendance, of which it says Alexi Sale, and it makes a reference to a file being opened in your name by Special Branch. And the reason it was open, well, maybe we can discuss, but that's where we got the information.
He didn't leave a review as well, did he? He didn't say something like, I found his performance, his fake philosophical tough performance unconvincing. Some of the attempts at bathos were frankly embarrassing. He didn't give a kind of...
Not that we know of.
Or I laughed. Yeah.
There might actually be a review in the file saying, don't bother.
Yeah, or I laugh till I drop my truncheon.
He's Scouse, but he's not Tom O'Connor.
yeah. That would have been the way that the police, I remember that somebody telling me that Bernard Manning's embassy club was often, which was a haven of racism and sexism, was often full of coppers. So,
yeah.
I think that's probably more the material. Actually, no, that's unfair, really, because actually I was... There was a certain type of copper who always, enjoyed my work, I think. There'd often be a small outing. Anyway, this is entirely irrelevant. I remember you telling me, because we talked about this on the phone, that you thought, tell me about what you think, and that the file could have actually been my family file, not just...
Well, I mean, the thing is about the what's becoming clear with the undercover policing inquiry, just for people who are catching up, there was a group called the Special Demonstration Squad, which was set up by the Metropolitan Police to investigate, political campaigns. It started with the Vietnam Solidarity Campaign, and it kind of got more active as it, investigated or spied on and monitored and infiltrated political organizations, upwards of, we've been told, 1,000. And it has, of course, infiltrated, the Socialist Workers' Party, the militant, the IMG, and, of course, mentions as well of the Communist Party of Great Britain, which I know that your folks were also involved in. And it's they've taken the opportunity, obviously, to spy on a whole number of different campaigns and groups over the course of its 40-odd year existence.
Yeah, well, there's a history of this. I don't think I mentioned this in the interview with Helen, but there's a G.K. Chesterton story called The Man Who Was Thursday, which is about a radical group. And it turns out over the short story that everybody in the group is a police agent provocateur. There's no genuine radical in the group. Everybody is a police agent from different organizations, you know, reporting on each other, really. And I remember reading somewhere that on the general council or whatever of the miners' union, two of Arthur Scargill's closest associates were actually police spies,
right.
I think.
That's right. I mean, in terms of the miners' union, you've got, I think it's Seamus Milne's book, The Enemy Within, talks about Roger Windsor being a potential MI5 spy. But I think with regards to the special demonstration squad, I mean, we've obviously made a number of statements to the inquiry. And one of the things I think, which is, I think, shocking, beyond the very disturbing things which I'm sure Helen spoke about or is speaking about in the podcast, is, you know, the use of dead children's identities to build up their own identity and the spying on family justice campaigns. But I think more broadly than that, I think from my perspective, the thing that has disturbed me in looking at this is the amount of officers, certainly from the 1974, who started taking positions in organisations. So in the case of one of the officers, an officer called Rick Gibson, which is his undercover name, he at one stage became the Joint National Secretary of the Troops Out movement.
Right.
And so the reason why that's disturbing, whether you agree with the Troops Out movement or not, is the fact that you've got a police officer making day-to-day decisions with regards to a campaign and a movement or a group. And I think that's got to be disturbing for democracy generally. It's got to be disturbing for the idea of people being able to organise and campaign around so many issues, which actually, when you look at it, I know from your perspective, being a left-wing person that you are, historically, you know, lots of these campaigns have been on the right side of history. And I think that's what's really disturbing. And I think that's going to be possibly a theme of this inquiry, is officers on the one hand taking positions, and then on the other hand, I think there's even accusations been made of them acting as agent provocateurs, like trying to get people into bother, which I think is also appalling. And it kind of questions, well, you know, what was the point of all this, you know?
Yeah. I know for a while there, in a lot of, like, in the, I think it was probably the 80s or the 90s, the villain in any kind of drama like Casualty or Minder or would always be an animal rights activist. Completely unfairly, animal rights activists in Holby were causing crashes of oil tankers and stuff. But you also wonder whether, because I think that those groups were infiltrated as well, whether there's some of the more egregious acts that animal rights activists performed were in fact instigated by agents provocateurs, by undercover police officers.
That's right. I mean, we've got reports of two members of the Socialist Party who were friends with an undercover officer, and this report, by the way, appeared in the Guardian some a couple of years ago, but it's kind of linked to the whole issue of undercover policing. And I don't know if you remember, there was, you may not remember, but there's an Italian fascist who was potentially linked with the bombing in Bologna.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd come to the UK, and for some reason, he wasn't extradited back to Italy. But he'd set up a charity shop, a kind of, I think it was linked, like a link to the Catholic Church or whatever. And this officer, these two guys in the Social Party were big anti-fascist campaigners and all the rest of it. And this officer in question tried to persuade them to firebomb the shop.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's in relatively recently. And, you know, in the kind of 1990s, early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And if that's an you know, there's allegations of that, but that's the kind of thing that the Special Demonstration Squad kind of began to morph into. It went from 1968, growing your hair long, sitting at the back of a meeting, taking notes, to by the mid-70s and 80s, taking positions in the organisations. And then in the 90s to 2000s, being a bit naughty and trying to be agent provocateurs, right. As well as all the obvious scandals which Helen talked about, which would be, you know, them, you know, having relationships with female activists, unbeknownst to those women, infiltrating, you know, family campaigns of people who've tragically died in custody.
Yeah.
You know, it's.
Yeah. I mean, do you think so? You're involved in now this. Government, this inquiry, which has been set up by the government into all these, is that proof that the system works?
Good question. I mean, the proof will be obviously at the end of the inquiry to see what happens. I mean, I personally have got no illusions in a public inquiry. There have been some good public inquiries that have come out and said some good things, or certainly force the issue. So we could think of, say, the McPherson inquiry into Stephen Lawrence's death, which, you know, basically, you know, one of the conclusions was there is institutional racism in the police and in institutions. So that was, you know, something positive that came out of it. You know, you'd have to say something like maybe the Hillsborough inquiry, although strictly not a public inquiry, was eventually after a period of time, you know, and a city and two football clubs and thousands of people campaigning, it can force the issue. It remains to be seen whether the inquiry will come out with anything which is substantially, we could say, well, that's good, or that's, you know, that at least it was worth it. But I suppose for many of the people I represent who, you know, span the political, you know, mainly, you know, Marxist left and peace activists, I think for them it's just knowing what went on is worth it in itself.
Right.
And for them to know how they were spied on and why they were spied on, the information, or at least some of the information that's held on them, it might be worth. As to whether Alexia comes out with anything which is substantial and good, well, you know, it remains to be seen, to be honest.
Several linked questions. There has just been this week or last week a large payout for a woman, an apology. I know she's not one of your clients, but can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so what I understand is, I mean, I know, you know, the woman in question is Kate Wilson, who is part of a group called Spies Out Lives, of the women who were, you know, had sexual, who were conned into having sexual relations with the police officers. And she tenaciously pursued this to the IPT, the Investigatory Powers Tribunal, I think that's what it's called, yes. And she has forced the police to disclose evidence that they probably wouldn't want to. And a pretty damning decision came out about 6 months ago against the police, and she's got a payout, and absolutely, quite rightly. She was in a relationship for a number of years. This copper met her family. I think the copper may have even been at possibly a grandmother's funeral. I may be wrong, maybe I'm getting confused, but I think that's correct. And, you know, was, as far as she was concerned, was, you know, someone who she was going to build a future and, I don't know, maybe even a family. And to be conned in that way is disgraceful, and you know, all power for her for pushing it forward, you know?
Yeah. There's also a case this week, I think it was really interesting, that the academic who had been in, I think, 2015, I don't know if I've got the dates right, was strip searched by the police after she had tried to give a card to a man, a young boy who was being stopped and searched. And there was a really interesting interview with her on Woman's Hour. She was interviewed by Emma Barnett, and Emma Barnett is somebody who I've got a kind of personal history with. But and I think Emma Barnett would have liked to have been more aggressive towards her, but couldn't given the nature of her story and stuff. But this woman was, I think, was pretty convinced that she had really no sympathy for the police. I think Emma Barnett was a bit trying to say, you know, either the odd rotten apple or, you know. I mean, what are your feelings about? Well, also, I'll just also bracket this with, I was watching the other night, 999, What's Your Emergency, which was, you know, which is which was featured the police, and I was only half watching it, but the police were, you saw the police dealing with these unbelievably difficult individuals, or like a woman who'd taken her three kids to the pub and then assaulted one of the customers, and then also the sort of several of the women police officers talked very movingly. One of them talked about how her own mother had been an alcoholic and had actually died because of her addiction, and you know, I think this had motivated her to become a police officer. So here you see these apparently very caring and, you know, highly motivated, almost police officers operating as a kind of arm of social, as a more effective arm of social care than the social services, really. I mean, whereas you also got this woman who has got no sympathy for the police force and really was implying that the police force is essentially an army of occupation, I suppose. And, you know, two kind of distinct views of the police. I wonder if you have a view of the police.
Yeah, I mean, it's always a difficult one, because obviously if a crime is committed, you know, against yourself, your house is robbed, or whatever, yeah, you know, who do you call? Well, it's yeah, not going to be Ghostbusters, is it?
it's not going to be an aging left-wing comedian.
Yeah. And so, you know, you've got, on the one hand, you know, I mean, you know, I'm a socialist. I mean, I understand that there needs to be a policing force of some degree, and it also needs, you know, and also we have to recognise, particularly with the impacts of austerity, the, you know, I think the state's capacity to care for people in the community, whatever, has been diminished. And I think the police are being called into positions where in the past they never would have been called into, you know, whether it's, you know, people who are dying on the streets or, you know, domestic crime or whatever. So on the one hand, you've got to acknowledge that whole swathes of police officers are, you know, caring and enter the role in that way. The problem I think we have, and is hinted at the first example you give, is an institutional problem. And the institutional problem is almost we're above the law and we can act above the law. And if we're called to account, our first step is not to, you know, maybe hold up our hands. Our first step is to duck and cover and hide and put that away. And I think there is a problem with the policing, the way policing is carried out in Britain. And I think, you know, even most recently you could see it with the fact that the Metropolitan Police was not prepared to touch an investigation on you know, Boris Johnson's knees ups at 10 Downing Street. But the, you know, they were fining people left, right, and centre up and down the country.
Yeah, I mean, I remember witnessing a lot of that shit, and it seemed like superficially also very racist that you would have a walk in a park and you would see massive numbers of police in the park harassing often black kids,
yes,
who were committing the crime of sitting down on the grass, basically.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So it was quite remote.
Exactly. And so, you know, it does feel at times when you're looking at what's happening with the case that you mentioned of the academic who eventually got a payout through, you know, horrific treatments when she was arrested. There is an institutional problem. And when we say an institutional one, what we mean is, I think the practices and what's, you know, the customs and practices eventually infect even the best people who go into the police service.
Yes.
It affects, so they may in their day-to-day jobs be, you know, as you say, be very caring, be very upset about stuff, but then they'll get tarnished and infected by these practices, which are then covered up or rooted out much later. And I think that's where, you know, we do have a problem with policing in this country. I really do. And the point you made about, you know, the harassment of particularly, you know, ethnic minorities, black and Asian young people, you know, that's been going on for decades and it doesn't seem to have really changed that much. It still goes on when there's a crisis or whatever, you know.
I mean, and certainly somebody like Cressida Dick, whose career I've to a degree followed, really, for some reason, because she attracted attention when she was head of Silver Watcher during the shooting of, she was the commander in charge during the shooting of John Charles, yes, the Menezes, wasn't she?
Yes.
And that was obviously, the truth of that never really emerged, but that was also, of course, to promote her, really, that she supervised the shooting of a perfectly innocent man on the tube station. Got a promote, and clearly Cressida Dick is somebody who is, I think, looks like a kind of an arch bureaucrat. She's obviously not the best copper in Britain, but is the best at rising to that position of being head of the Metropolitan Police.
Yeah, and I think she's probably been she's been infected by the same, problems that institutionally the police have got, a problem with.
Yes, I mean, she seems very rigorous in resisting any efforts at reform, really, while talking the talk, occasionally pretending to be.
And then being dragged into, you know, effectively being dragged to now investigate, the parties that were carrying on in 10 Downing Street. You know, the Met have been literally dragged there.
Yeah.
By public opinion and the fact that it's actually no longer sustainable, really. But what a situation. They've been exposed in that way when they should have been on the front foot. Because if they're happy to fine people, you know, 100, 200 quid for three people together in a park, then, you know, it's unsustainable that you do not investigate, you know, the powers that be when they are clearly or seemingly clearly breaching the rules, you know. I always put in seemingly as a lawyer just to save yourself from any shenanigans later on, you know.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Well, I sympathise. I mean, do you think they're still under? Do you think the police have changed, really, apart from learning the talk, really? Do you think there's a fundamental difference between the police of the 70s and the 80s and now?
I don't know. It's hard to see. In terms of undercover policing, obviously it's a lot easier now with social media, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, Helen talks about that, yeah.
It's so much easier. Is there undercover policing? Possibly. I mean, it's still going on. I mean, what was going on in the past, I think, is indefensible. And I would stress this, and, you know, I guess that a lot of the people who listen to the podcast, like myself, are probably left of centre. Mm-hmm. But it is quite stark in this inquiry, and it is stark when you look at who was targeted. So you have the likes of CND, you have the likes of the peace movement and left-wing organisations targeted. And the far right, who are responsible for quite horrific racist attacks, particularly in the 70s and 80s, are barely touched. I mean, the irony is that in one case, an officer infiltrated the Workers' Revolutionary Party, and he was then tasked by the Workers' Revolutionary Party to go to National Front meetings. So the and then the WRP didn't know he was an officer. They were just sending him in. And in fact, they did more work than the actual Metropolitan Police did in terms of trying to investigate the National Front, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite a disturbing part of this inquiry.
And it sort of hints at the police really being not a, you know, not an organisation which exists to find our lost cats or, you know, protect us, but is an instrument of state repression, really.
Well, and that's what we definitely pointed out in the opening statements that we made to the inquiry, is that, you know, you had these criminal gangs harassing at the time, particularly in the 70s, like Asian shopkeepers in Brick Lane and all the rest of it. That's going on. You have racist murders, and they're spending their time worried about, in one case, as we put in our, you know, we had a report from one officer to his seniors about the SWP babysitting rota, you know. and who wants to know that, you know? It just seems absolutely mental.
Yeah, yeah. I think I would have loved to be a copper in some ways, though. Have a gun. Must be great. Sometimes, yeah, because I'm a firearms fan. I'm sort of looking at, if I'm in an airport and I'm looking at their weaponry, you know, whether they got like an MP7 or an MP5 or a Glock 17. They get a bit twitchy, really, when an elderly bearded man stares at their weaponry for too long. I mean, because I suppose the substance of this is the interview with Helen, really, so we don't want to go on. Have you got anything else you want to say, Paul, about that?
I mean, not really. I mean, for me, it's fascinating, and really, I'm really, what I'm particularly interested in as I work in the inquiry is trying to examine the role that the individual officers played in where they took up positions of power in these organisations, and the impact that had in either derailing the organisation. I'm also particularly interested in the impacts of blacklisting that has potentially come out of the inquiry. We know, in terms of one of my clients who was in the Troops Out movement, that after he got married and had kids, he found it virtually impossible to get a job, even though he's really well qualified. And that personal impact as well, and the information which often the officers who give evidence are saying, well, it was fairly innocuous and this, that, and the other. Clearly, I don't think it was innocuous, and it really did have an impact on it. But I also hope that, you know, at the end or during the course of the inquiry, people take solace from the fact that, you know, there are campaigners out there prepared to, you know, push the button and you know, 99 times out of 100, the campaigns that have been spied on have been proved to be on the right side of history.
Yeah, the hoped for defenestration of Boris Johnson would also mean the removal of Priti Patel, who is the most right-wing, I mean, personally incompetent, I think, but the most right-wing Home Secretary that there has ever been.
Certainly, I mean,
and somebody who is very much pushing forward. I mean, I suppose it's a separate issue, really, the new policing bill, which, you know, seeks to limit, you know, I mean, I think we live it. I mean, I sort of say this to Helen, really, but, you know, we think we live in a free society, and I think that's quite, you know,
I've never known, I mean, you know, you can always say I've never known a time like this. But in terms of legislation which the government is planning, which you touched on with the new policing bill, then there's potentially limits on how judicial review works, which is effectively a legal approach to holding national and local government to account. That's being limited. The potential for the Human Rights Act to be curtailed. And then I was just reading the other day the proposals in a document which have come out about the Official Secrets Act, and the Official Secrets Act making whistleblowing much harder and making it more of a criminal offence, which is undoubtedly linked to the case of Julian Assange. So that swathe of legislation which is coming in, you know, has to be a massive concern, not just for the, the left, just, lefties and busybodies, but, for, the whole of, particularly, trade union movements and working class organisations across the country, because if this comes through, not only will it curtail your rights to hold the government to account or to use the Human Rights Act, which is used in many cases positively, not like to save somebody's cat or whatever, but it's used to, but it's the, like you said before, the curtailing of protest. It's really,
it is next stop fascism, isn't it? I mean, without being alarmist, without being alarmist, we're heading for a fascist state.
Well, in the absence of armed bodies of men, I mean, it's really worrying, and I hope that we see the beginnings of a movement that can really stop it in its tracks.
Yeah. Maybe we should talk about that. It's an ally. Maybe it'd be a good idea to have a separate talk about that in greater detail, really, because it is, we drifting very much. I mean, that definitely Boris Johnson, underneath all the kind of socially liberal policies, is also, there are people around him who are profoundly authoritarian, really, much more so than any other, conservative administration. And I think maybe we should look at that in greater detail in another episode, I think. Yeah, let's do that. Let's do that. All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Paul. And we'll go on to the interview with Helen now. But we'll get, I think we really should talk about that in greater detail, really, because it is, it is profoundly what she's a fucking arsehole. Bastard shitbag. Fucking pretty good tell. I am with Helen Steele now, who is... Helen, can you tell me about... the whole thing, really. I mean, what your involvement in the SpyCop scandal is, what it is, and also, you told me before we started recording that you have part of your story, which takes place in the street, also shows Keir Starmer in a good light. Now, I think it's a barometer of my honesty as a journalist and as a person that I am going to allow this story. As regular listeners to my podcast will know, there is nobody in the world that I hate more than Keir Starmer. But nevertheless, your story shows him being a good, kind, generous person, and so I'm gonna let that go ahead. That's me.
That's not the start of the story.
No. So from the beginning, I guess.
Right. Well, I became politically active in my teens, and involved in sort of social and environmental justice campaigns. And in 1987, I got involved with a group called London Greenpeace, which is actually independent of the better known, bigger Greenpeace. Again, that was campaigning on environmental and social justice issues. And not long after I started going to the meetings, a guy started coming along called John Barker. He said that he had spent part of his childhood in New Zealand. He was very friendly, very helpful. He used to offer us lifts home from the meeting. And generally, a lot of the people were living in Hackney, squatting in Hackney, whereas I was living in Tottenham, and I'd be the last person dropped off. And so I used to sit up the front of his van with him. And over time, we started a relationship. You know, he came to me and told me about the death of his father, the death of his mother. He leaned on me for emotional support. We became very close. We even moved into a flat together. And then we'd been in a relationship for over a year, he started behaving erratically. doing, you know, disappearing, coming back, saying he was having an emotional breakdown because he had, his parents were dead, he had nobody left and nobody loved him. And, you know, I didn't really know how to handle all of this. He told me he was deeply in love with me. He wanted to have children with me. I felt the same about him. And then finally he disappeared altogether. Now, this is long and complicated. I tried to track him down because I was worried about him. And everything that I investigated turned out to be false. Now, kind of running parallel to this, when I was still in a relationship with him, I got served a writ by McDonald's claiming that they had been libeled by a London Greenpeace fact sheet. So I started fighting this libel case against McDonald's. Two of us, there were five of us sued originally, and two of us decided to fight it. And that was where I met Keir Starmer, because we went to see a lawyer. Well, first we went to see a different lawyer, a solicitor, and he said he knew absolutely nothing about libel. We needed a specialist lawyer. He introduced us to Keir Starmer. Keir Starmer very kindly agreed to take on helping us draft our defence. He did it for free. He really was fantastic at the time. I've got no idea what he's doing now, but he certainly was great at the time. Anyway, so obviously we weren't actually represented. He wasn't representing us. He helped us draft the pleadings. And eventually we got into a court case. Well, the court case became the longest case in English legal history. It lasted between 1994 to 1996, and then the verdict was in 1997. During the time that I was going to court every day, one day suddenly on the way back, I used to pass St. Catherine's House, which was where the registry of births, deaths and marriages was.
Mm-hmm.
Something made me go in there,
mm-hmm.
and look through the death records and for my partner's name.
Right.
And I got about eight years after his, what I thought was his date of birth, mm-hmm. I discovered a record that was actually, he had been using the name of a child who died when he was eight years old.
I mean, did your heart stop at that point, or did you suspect that that was going to be the case?
No, well, I mean, when he disappeared, there were a number of possibilities, like, you know, one of which was that he could have been an undercover policeman. Another was that McDonald's had actually sent private investigators into the group as well. They'd had seven private investigators spying on London Greenpeace over a period of 2 years.
Those huge red wigs and big shoes gave them away. Sorry, I couldn't resist that.
And then another one was that he was possibly on the run himself from the police. You know, I didn't know what was going on, but because one of the possibilities was that he could have been an undercover policeman, when I read the certificate, I kind of fell apart, really, because this was the person who I thought I knew best suddenly didn't exist.
Mm.
You know, it wasn't a real person. And if you can live with somebody and think you know them really well, and actually they don't exist,
mm.
what does that say for all the rest of your relationships?
Yeah.
And so I just kind of retreated into myself, not really knowing who I could trust. And also kind of being conscious of the fact that if I talked about what I'd found out, they might make it harder for me to find out the truth about who he was.
Yeah.
So I didn't really talk about it apart from to, you know, a few select friends, which included my co-defendant in the McLibel trial, Dave Morris. And he actually said, because he saw how upset I was, and he said, well, you know, even if he had been undercover, it's possible that he had genuinely loved you.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, the whole thing was so painful that I suppose it was almost comforting to believe that might be a possibility.
Mm.
So, I mean, yeah, that was in 1994. I found that out. And as I say, the McLibel trial went on till 1997. And I don't know, my mind was on other things. Then I fought the McLibel appeal as well. That was
Did you win in the end?
1999. Yeah. Well, then we took it to the European Court of Human Rights, and we won in the European Court of Human Rights. The European Court of Human Rights ruled that we hadn't had a fair trial, that being up against a multi-billion company with endless money to spend on the court case while we were basically on a shoestring wasn't fair. We proved part of the statements in the leaflets, you know, about the poor nutritional value of the food, the low pay, cruelty to animals, the kind of exploitation of children through their advertising strategy. So we won part of the, you know, the claims that were in the leaflet, but there were others that we didn't win. And so we actually got ordered to pay them. Originally, it was £60,000 damages, and then it got reduced on appeal to £40,000 damages. But we didn't pay anything. We just said, we're not paying. You don't deserve that money. And they didn't come after us, I think, because they knew they'd be on a hiding to nothing, and it would damage their reputation more.
Yeah, I suppose there's. I mean, it's a common tactic now that anybody I think on the left encounters is this tactic of lawfare, which ties you up, doesn't it? For years.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, strategic lawsuits against public participation.
Is that the, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's I think. The American term,
right.
But it's a definitely a recognized phenomenon that they sue people, huge corporations sue people,
yeah.
not only to, you know, try and intimidate you, but also to tie you up in litigation, which then means you can't carry on the campaigns that you were
right.
involved with.
Yeah.
So it's got a kind of dual purpose, and obviously it intimidates other people around
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, and that has spread now outwards, not just from large corporations, but to other special interest groups.
Yeah.
Say,
really. Yes.
So anyway, in the end, you got a judgment from the European that said it wasn't. Thank God we've not got anything to do with that anymore.
Oh, actually, we have. We're still part of the European Convention on Human Rights. It's separate to the. There's two kind of European court. So, one's for the European Convention on Human Rights, and the other European court is more to do with kind of trade and employment issues. And I think it's that one we're not part of anymore.
Okay, we're still part of the other one.
We are still part of the.
Well, that's a good thing then, isn't it? Okay, so that. In the end, concluded, as it were, the whole saga.
That concluded the McLibel case. Mm-hmm. After that was over, I went to New Zealand to see family. And just before I went in fact, it wasn't after that was over. It was before we got the European judgment. The BBC screened a program called True Spies, which was about this secret unit in... special branch that was infiltrating political campaigns in this country. And as part of that program, they talked about infiltrating trade unions, the environmental movement, all sorts of social justice campaigns. Yeah.
Nobody from the right, they never infiltrated. No,
well, actually, they did infiltrate a few groups from the right, but by and large...
They'd probably fit in better there. Kaboom. Yeah. Hi, my name's Ben Elton. Yeah, sorry, go on.
By and large, yes, it was left groups that they were, or groups that were on the left that they were targeting.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things mentioned in that program was about you know sleeping with people in order to obtain information. You know, I was quite disturbed by what I heard in that program, and because John had originally said he was from New Zealand, when I was over there, I decided to do some research. And I'll cut a long story short because it was over a couple of visits. But eventually I found out that I found John's marriage certificate in his real name. And his marriage certificate stated police officer. And then the thing I kind of thought, well, that's it. I know the answer now. But actually, when I talked to people, they were like, no, that wouldn't happen in this country. You're being paranoid. You know, the police wouldn't go to those lengths in this country. And I tried to research it more and I couldn't find you know, conclusive proof, because the marriage certificate was from about 10 years before my relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people had sort of said, well, you know, maybe he'd been embarrassed about being in the police, so he'd invented a fake name before he got involved in London Greenpeace. But anyway, in 2010, I was contacted by a woman, a letter was passed on to me from a woman who I'd known, whose partner had also disappeared around about 2000, I think. And when I went to visit her, her story was absolutely just shocking. She had been in a relationship with this guy. He disappeared. She eventually found him. He admitted that he'd been an undercover policeman, but then spun her a whole series of lies about how he'd actually, he'd been put in there as part of a criminal investigation, and they'd realised they'd got it all wrong. They should never have infiltrated the group. He was really sorry. He actually had decided that he quite liked the group. And he kind of gaslit her into believing that he was the one who wanted to escape from the police and da-di-da-di-da. Anyway, within a couple of weeks, she was pregnant. And then he basically controlled her until she managed to escape to a women's refuge, after which she got the letter to me. But during the course of their relationship, he had said to her that my ex-partner had been an undercover policeman. Right. So I finally had that confirmation. And by this time, I don't know if you recall the Mark Kennedy case, who infiltrated the environmental movement. That was coming out into the open around the same time. The police were calling it, you know, saying that he was a rogue officer. you know, he'd gone off and done his own thing. It wasn't their fault. It was all his fault. He was a bad apple.
Well, he was supposed to be on traffic duty or something.
Well, whatever excuses it was, they were trying to make out it was all just him. And by this point, I knew not only about the woman who told me, but another woman who I'd met who was involved in the Colin Roach Centre in Hackney, fighting against racism and, you know, police violence police malpractice. Her partner had gone missing. So we got together to bring a court case against the police for these undercover officers deceiving us into relationships. And when we finally launched the case, there were 8 women who had been deceived by 5 different undercover police officers over a period spanning about 24 years. And, you know, you could really see that this wasn't just one bad apple. This was like a whole systemic practice that they were using women in order to, you know, shore up the fake identities of these undercover cops.
Do you think he was still married when he was?
Yes, he was really? Still married, yeah. Yeah.
Fucking hell. So
many of the men were. Many of the men.
What were they? I mean, did their wives know?
No, they were hidden from their wives. And in fact, like a lot of the wives divorced them once they found out.
Yeah. I mean, what kind of a fucking psychopath does that?
Yeah. No,
does
it's
that?
Really sick. Really
yeah.
Sick.
I mean, that's.
Yikes. It's devastated, you know, them as well as us. So
yeah.
It demonstrates a kind of institutional sexism that they thought that they could use us, but also that they had such disregard for, you know, their wives that you know, they were happy to lie to them about the fact that they were in relationships with us.
Staggering. I mean, this is a slight kind of digression. What do you think? Do you have a theory now about who they are? I mean, in the sense of who they are psychologically, what kind of people? I mean, what kind of person would do this? Would be this?
I think they're really warped. I don't know. I mean, for most of us, these were like the most intense relationships we'd ever had. It was kind of like they knocked you off your feet, and I think part of it is their training. They, in order to, like, so if you infiltrate a group, if you're always arguing with people, you don't really make links, get on and find out what's going on. You have to be friendly. So people kind of think, I mean, actually, they do a bit of shit stirring as well. But a large part of their strategy is to be really useful, to do the jobs that people
don't want
to
do. They've always got a van, haven't they?
They've always got a van.
Yeah.
They offer to drive you places. When they offer to drive you home from a meeting, it means they find out where you live.
Right.
And they are generally really friendly to everybody so that they can, you know, people then start trusting them and telling them things. And part of this thing about, getting on with people, what they do is they mirror people. So, right. You know, if you like country and Western, they'll say they like country and Western.
Yeah.
If you said you like reggae, they'll say they like reggae. And so you, like when we were in relationships, it felt like we'd met our kind of match in heaven sort of
yeah.
thing. And they, you know, they told us that they loved us and it was really intense. And yeah. so, when they disappeared, it was actually really hard to believe that it wasn't at least in part real.
Yes.
But I think now I don't
really?
Think it was real.
That's very bleak.
I think
bleak,
it's just,
yeah.
it is bleak. It's, yeah. it's, I just think it's like an extreme form of manipulation and they didn't care that they were using us and wrecking our lives.
So these are people who've joined the police force, the Lovable. These are people who are deeply disturbed, then you would say now. I mean, it seems to me that they are, but they are people who've risen through the ranks of the police force to become whatever their official title. Are they special branch?
Yeah, they're special branch, but it was even a smaller unit than special branch. It was a kind of secret unit within special branch. They had roughly 10 officers on the go at any one time,
right.
Infiltrating a range of I think they had one for North London anarchists, they had one for South London anarchists, they had like different socialist groups.
Do you think they at least have some like deeply right-wing political beliefs, or they believe nothing? It's only the manipulation that gets them off that they believe absolutely zero, really, or do they think they're fighting?
I think it's complicated. I mean, there is now an undercover, a public inquiry into undercover policing. It was announced, there was a TV program, oh God, what year was it? I think 2013 or 14, Channel 4 Dispatches. Rob Evans and Paul Lewis from The Guardian had been doing a series of reports about undercover policing. They brought out their book around the same time the Channel 4 screened their documentary. And Peter Francis, who was in this secret unit and became a whistleblower, was on this TV program, and he talked about how while he'd been undercover, they had been spying on the grieving family of Stephen Lawrence,
right.
At the time that the Lawrence inquiry was coming up, or might even be while it was going on, but in order to get kind of advance information about what was going to be said so that they could then undermine it in the inquiry.
They have a kind of allegiance to the Metropolitan Police, perhaps, a kind of a, you know.
I think the whole unit was a combination of trying to sabotage any groups that were trying to sort of bring about social change,
mm-hmm.
social progress, and also undermining any groups that were criticizing the police or the state in any way. So his revelations, Peter Francis's revelations.
Was
in
you met
program,
him? Or...
Yeah, well, we met him on the program.
Right.
Yeah.
And he's somebody who had an epiphany, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, he was. Yeah. I mean, he felt bad about what he'd done, and he's gone on record, you know, saying that they shouldn't have been in those campaigns. And also we talked about the undercover relationships on this TV program. And at that point, the then Home Secretary, Theresa May, then instigated a kind of inquiry. And then the outcome of that inquiry was that there'd be a proper public inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
That only finally got underway at the end of last year in November.
Is Priti Patel in charge of it?
Well, she is now.
I mean, that woman seems like a sack. Somebody was talking to me about, they said, I think somebody worked with her and they were saying she's the kind of woman who would unplug your life support machine to charge your phone.
Possibly, yeah.
Anyway, sorry.
I don't know. I haven't met
her. Yeah,
so.
Yeah. No, she might be lovely.
Yeah, some of the officers have given evidence already. So at the moment, the public inquiry was looking at the time period from when the unit was set up, when the Special Demonstrations Squad was set up in 1968 in response to the mass protests against the Vietnam War, through to I think they're about the mid 70s. I'm not sure where they're up to, actually. I've lost track of time.
Where does this, what form does it take, this public inquiry?
Well, it's been a little strange because originally it was supposed to be in an open courtroom, but because of COVID, what happened was we're allowed into a room to watch the officers on screens and the judges somewhere else as well. So we are just watching it on a screen.
The officers are masked though, or you can see them?
You can see them, but they won't allow the officers' faces, right. Or they weren't allowing their voices either to be broadcast, apart from if you went to this one hotel. And obviously because of COVID, lots of people couldn't travel down to London to see it. So, you know, people were denied access to watching the inquiry.
Did you go in?
I initially stayed at home to watch it over the internet, and then I just found it so frustrating that I decided I would take the risk and go down to London and sit in this hotel.
What was that?
I didn't get COVID. It's better being able to watch it. You can kind of see their facial expressions.
Did you see the your partner?
Not yet. No. So at the moment, the inquiry is actually divided into a whole load of tranches, and they're on tranche one, which is 1968 to 1982. But then they split that into three phases because they said they weren't ready because of COVID. So we've had now phase one and phase two, but not phase three of tranche one. And then tranche two will be when that covers the period when I was spied on. So at the moment, I haven't seen any of the officers who spied on me, but it is interesting watching them. I mean, you get the impression that some of them think that what they did was very wrong, but most of them think that they were doing a great job for kind of Queen and country or something, even though they were probably, I don't know. To me, it looks entirely like a waste of time, but also an interference with, the right to protest and interference with democracy as well.
I suppose and this is often the case, isn't it, with public inquiries, that the conclusion that's reached and the kind of impression that is given along the way is that this stuff is historic, that it was very much a function of the 70s and the 80s, and it wouldn't happen now. Do you believe any of that?
Not at all, no. And in fact, when the eight women brought our original case, we launched the case at the end of 2011, and one of the women had actually exposed her partner when they were still in a relationship, and this was in October 2010. So it was only the year before. It very much is not a historic practice. We don't have evidence about what they're specifically doing since 2010, and I think that's one of their strategies, is actually to make this drag on for so long that they can claim it's historic, because now we're 11 years after she blew it up into the open. I'm quite sure that they are still spying on people. I think there was a recent case now where they use slightly different methods, although they were also recruiting informers back then. But now they more use informers, but they also have social media, obviously, because so much of protests and what have you that are organised now are organised over social media or talked about over social media, and so they can monitor it much more easily without actually having a physical person.
Right, but they just have a fake online identity.
Yeah.
When is the public inquiry likely to conclude? You don't know, really. And what do you think it's going to say?
Well, so when it was announced, and I think it formally opened, I'm trying to think, it kind of formally opened in 2015, but then it didn't actually start hearing evidence until last year. And it was supposed to be making disclosure. The police have kind of obstructed disclosure at every phase. You know, they have this ridiculous redaction process. Even we're talking about documents that are 50 years old, and they're saying they have to go through like something like 8 different pairs of eyes to work out whether if they do or don't redact a particular word, someone might be able to work out who it was, or, you know, it might have implications for public national security, or, you know, some such nonsense. You know, it really is ridiculous. The documents are so old. The reality is that they're trying to engage in a cover-up, because they know that if the public understood the true extent of spying in this country, they would be outraged.
Yes. I mean, the kind of outfall for me of the, or the fallout for me of the whole Jeremy Corbyn last 5 years has been, I thought I was cynical and realistic, and I knew that the way the world was, but I think the level of, for me, the level of media bias and the level of sabotage during the Corbyn years made me realise that the world that we live in is an illusion, really. It's completely false. I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but is that kind of what you feel, that it's all a lie, right?
I think so. I think there is a complete illusion of us living in some form of democracy when actually so much of you know, politics is controlled behind the scenes. You know, what has emerged is that they've still got all these records from 50 years ago. Now, why would you keep all those records? And I think that when Jeremy Corbyn became the leader, you see all these little stories coming out into the open, and they're an attempt to basically smear and, you know, portray people as untrustworthy. And that's why they actually want all this information on file. It's so that if you ever get into a position where you might be challenging their power, they can wheel something out to try and undermine you. The photograph of you on a platform with somebody in whatever year it was that everybody had actually forgotten about, but now it's quite handy. Absolutely. And that it has more significance than it did back then, when nobody actually knew who any of those people were.
Yeah.
And it's just a way to really control.
It's all a lie, isn't it?
But I think the other side of it is, you know, it is easy to... and, you know, I've had enough moments when I've just kind of felt really cynical about politics altogether, because, you know, who can you trust anymore when you realise that your ex-partner was an undercover copper?
Yeah.
But the other side of it is to realise that the fact that they do keep files on us means that they and that they do spy on our groups means that they do actually realise that when we are talking to other people about, you know, the change that we want to see in the world, it does have an effect.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true from, you know, if you hand out leaflets on the street, the anti-McDonald's campaign was actually a really popular campaign. People would regularly, you know, they take a leaflet and then they tell us their little anecdote about a bad experience they'd had, or, you know, had they worked there and been paid really bad wages, or, you know, something like that. And people are looking for alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way you can really create alternatives is to talk to other people.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
About what kind of world you want to see. So you have to have that political organisation. You have to have demonstrations so that people know that there is opposition to what the government are doing, or that you want things to be done differently. Like, for example, with climate change, you know, you want an end to the destruction of the planet just to make a, you know, quick profits for a tiny minority of people.
Yeah.
But we also have to realise that those that hold power will try and sabotage those movements and just do what they can to try and stop them.
I mean, I think in a way that, you know, in the way that those, I kind of think now, in the way that those cops were ill, those, you know, all the Jeff Bezos, the rich people are ill as well. It's a different kind of illness in a way, but it's a kind of insanity in a sense to want to have. So I don't know.
Yeah, okay. No. Well, I agree. I kind of think, what do you want with, like?
Yeah. What do you need 11
when
houses?
When you've got 1 million, what do you want with more than 1 million? Like, you know, couldn't even spend 1 million in the rest of my lifetime.
Yeah. I also think in a way that, you know, it's one of the things about being rich, is that, you know, your life is completely bound up with rules and, like, you know, you have to wear kind of stupid, you know, like stupid little outfits, you know, and go to balls and I don't know, you know, eat stupid food, ridiculous.
I did go to one event where I was quite shocked by the food, but anyway, no, generally I've not moved in those circles, so I don't really know, but
I have a bit.
But it is
it's awful. It's horrible.
I do think there's something wrong with people who just can't stop trying to amass more money when they could never spend what they've got already. Yeah. And there are people all around them that are suffering and in need. Yeah. It's like, you know, the empathy deficit is just like incredible.
But all our lives are distorted to keep these few people, you know.
Yes, totally.
Maintain their fucking habit, really.
Yeah,
you know?
And not just our lives, you know, we run the risk of destroying the entire planet.
That as well, yeah.
Because of the greed of a tiny minority of people.
Yeah.
It's absolute insanity. We've had a limited amount of information so far from the public inquiry. Basically covering the period from 1968 through to
this is when 1970s. My file was.
But what the core participants in the public inquiry, this is core participants are people who the inquiry knows have basically been spied on at some point in their lives, and so they've been granted this status of, you know, being able to, in theory, have your lawyer represent you. In practice, they are constantly trying to cut costs, and our lawyers have to do combined statements, which is extremely difficult when there's like over 200 people. But one of the things that we have been calling for as core participants is for, firstly, a release of all of the names of the groups that were spied on. Mm-hmm. They have admitted that there are over 1,000 groups that were spied on. And we're saying they need to release the names of those groups so that the people that were in those groups can come forward and give evidence about what those officers did. We've also consistently called for all of the cover names, that's the fake names of the officers, to be made public, so that people who were spied on by them, again, can come forward. The inquiry has allowed considerable numbers of them. I've lost track of what it is. It's somewhere, I don't know, a third or half of officers have been allowed to retain anonymity. So there's a huge number of them that we don't even know their cover names, let alone their real names. And how can anyone give evidence about what they did if we don't have their cover names? It's absolutely ridiculous. It's a, you know, the police are being allowed to control the evidence that's coming out in the inquiry. And then the final thing that we've been demanding is that for core participants, we should all be given the special branch files that were collated on us by these officers, because it's only us that can really interpret them and draw attention to, you know, the inquiry, where that information has been obtained by, you know,
do you think it, I mean,
by what it, means.
Do you think if you saw your file, it would be, I know when, you know, the Stasi who released their files in East Germany, people found out that their husbands and wives were.
No, it could be
another,
another layer of extreme pain. Yes.
Yeah, so I wonder a bit about if I ever saw my file that, you know, yeah, people you'd.
Yeah, it is a difficult question, but at the same time, like for certainly for the women who have been deceived into relationships, you know, the men, when we were in relationships, had you know, access to the entire contents of our heads, and you know, a lot of us want answers to, you know, what, how much of that was recorded, put on file, and what it might have been used for as well.
Yeah.
And who knew about it, how high up the chain it went.
Yeah.
Because without those, we just don't have the, you know, we don't have the answers, and the worry, it kind of plays over and over in your mind about, you know.
Yeah, well, it, you know, I said it destabilizes. Yeah, the whole, you know, you what's true, what's false. You know, it must be profoundly disturbing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's amazing. I think it's amazing. Powerful testimony.
Just to mention one other thing, which is that, like, if people are interested in this, there's actually three good websites that they can get more information. The website about undercover police having relationships with women is called Police Spies Out of Lives. There's the Undercover Research Group, which has kind of details about each of the different officers and what we know about which groups were spied on so far. And then there's the Campaign Opposing Police Surveillance, which is more of a sort of campaign website that publicises what's going on with the, you know, with the inquiry and the various different challenges to undercover policing. So they're good resources, good absolutely. For people to have a look at.
Check those out. We'll put a copy of those links in the podcast description as well.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Well, I think this is one of our... That's amazing. It stems from my crappy performance at a People's March for Jobs show. My memory of that is that, which is what the, they had like really top bands and stuff. It was organized by the TUC. And even though like Madness were on, it was empty because the fucking trade unionists were so disorganized they couldn't even fucking give away the tickets. They, just a bitter memory of the left from me, just to undercut things.
Maybe there was someone sabotaging it. Who knows?
Hey, you know, that's right. Yes. Maybe they were, yeah, because we...
It's possible.
Yeah.
It's possible.
God, I never thought of that. That time I didn't sell out the White Rock Theatre in Hastings, it wasn't because of people hate me. It's because police interference.
Well, it's because it was organised by an... No, I don't know.
No.
I don't know.
Not it is when you start thinking about it, though. I mean, yeah, we saw this with the Labour Party, that the people in head office were conspiring against Corbyn.
Yeah,
you know, stuff you couldn't believe, really. Yeah. And most people won't refuse to believe it. So it is how far
we do know that at least some of the officers have kind of spread disinformation within groups that they were in and tried to. You know, sabotage them effectively by creating division between people.
Maybe you're saying that the whole splittist nature of the left could be that. Well, some of it, anyway.
I think. I mean, there
they
is an element
they've got.
Yeah, I think. Yeah. I think that. I mean, one of the lessons from this is actually that we all, if we're involved in trying to create change, we all need to make an effort to try and work with each other and not at each other's throats over what the differences are.
Yeah, yeah.
We need to be like trying to think how we can work together.
I think that's
because undercover officers
point.
Will definitely hone in on any division and try and use it to drive a wedge and destroy the movement.
I think that's such an amazingly accurate point, and that's what we've been talking about a bit on this podcast, that the left not only has to, you know, organize better, but has to, you know, it has to build in stuff like that where you don't argue with each other, but because that can be used by your enemies. But yeah, find what unites you.
I mean, I think it's okay to argue with each other, but do it in a constructive way, not you know, condemn and denounce and what have you. You try and persuade people that maybe they should have a look at things in a different way or something like that. But this kind of like assumption that, you know, people are deliberately working from evil motives or, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
Or that you hate them because they think this or that is that's what's the negative part.
Yeah.
You know, we should be able to have discussions on all sorts of areas. You know, where we see things slightly differently, we all have different life experiences. We should be able to talk about those without being at each other's throats.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that's what creates a kind of movement that people want to be part of. You know, I know when I got involved in politics, if I went to groups where people were at each other's throats, I just kind of I wanted to run in the other direction. I didn't understand what it was about.
And there's too much of that still.
Yeah, there is.
You know, I was at a conference the other week and there's a lot of that nonsense going on. And it has to stop.
So that was Paul Heron of the Public Interest Law Centre, and then Helen Steele, one of the women who was conned into a relationship with an undercover police officer. And I think this podcast proves that you don't have to watch The Matrix to realise that the world you think you live in is not the world that you actually live in. So this is Alexi Sayles saying goodbye, and you're being watched. You've been listening to the Alexi Sayles podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Anthony Overton for the sound mixing. And to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexisalepodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.